there is go to the class website, and for today at least, I put in a link to a doodle poll for presentation topics, first come, first served. I will send out mail through Blackboard or something like that so that people are not too inconvenienced by not being here in class to hear that reminder, but I'll remind folks about it at the end of class as well. These are the presentations. Remember, the last day of class and maybe even the last week of class is going to be student presentations as in lieu of a final exam. We don't actually have that many more weeks, right? There's counting starting next week, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 weeks of class, and that's it. So we are a little bit past the halfway mark. Not surprising, considering that we just had a midterm. So I will send out that reminder to everybody that's registered for the class. Hey, Suba.
Hi.
So that's okay. Suba just survived a design meeting for LHC crab cavities. Happy birthday to will.i.am.
Oh.
One of my favorite, my second favorite of the Black Eyed Peas. Fergie's always close to my heart.
Yeah.
Ruth Bader Ginsburg, definitely my favorite Supreme Court justice. And Zoras Alferov, who is a Russian, who is probably one of the most influential and littlest known physics Nobel Prize winners. You guys were all alive in 2000. You probably weren't paying attention to the Nobel Prizes. Maybe you weren't even alive in 2000. Anybody have any idea who this guy is? So he is one of the fathers of modern metamaterials. If you look at things like, okay, transistors or PN and NP junctions, and extending that idea of two different types of material, semiconductors next to each other to various layers and stuff like that. He was one of the early prototype people that fathered essentially the entire science of metamaterials to the point where modern LEDs, multicolor LEDs, all build on his work. Fundamentally, you know, every time you look at your cell phone screen, think of Zoras Alferov, because it wouldn't be there without his seminal work in metamaterials and prototype mixed type semiconductors. And Stephen Hawking. Aw, okay. R.I.P. Stephen Hawking, who died yesterday. So I added in the slides that I posted from Tuesday, so you can see what I'm doing as I'm taking photos literally of the things that I write down and posting that along with audio for the class, along with all of the slide numbers and stuff like that. And on Tuesday, we went through some discussion about distributions of particles and how you can take moments of those distributions, in particular centroids and sizes or RMS of those distributions, and then how those things transform using our standard tools, right? So centroids look like single particles, move like single particles, which is great because now if I want to measure something like M, if I want to measure, instead of just calculate from the magnets, this transport matrix, what I can do is I can put in a distribution that has a centroid that is perhaps zero in one of these coordinates and not zero in the other, then measure these things sometime later on and calculate that, you know, measure directly that M. And we'll get into how we measure the centroids of these particle distributions later on today. That's part of today's lecture. And then there's also doing a little bit of fancy matrix stuff. We figured out not only how the centroids transform, but how also the beam sizes transform. And you can see that the simple equation actually is the transformation of the beam sizes squared, right? Because we ended up multiplying positions together against each other, taking a correlation matrix, it's called, calculating that out, and then seeing that that was directly related to the beam size squared, or this correlation, this diagonal correlation squared. And how that all relates to our good old alphas and betas, from Courant Snyder descriptions, right? So we'll get into today. It's some of it is about, okay, how do we measure properties of the beam? We'll talk about centroids. We'll talk about beam sizes and how we measure those. But let's start first at something even a little bit more important or more primitive, so to speak, which is, so we want to characterize this distribution of particles. What's the current? You know, how many particles are in the beam? Not even, you know, where are they? Just how many are there as they go past a particular point? Or how? What's the current or what's the charge per set of this distribution? We'll talk about that first and talk about ways to measure that. You already kind of know how to measure a current. Put it in the circuit, put an ammeter on it, you measure the current. Well, you can't exactly put an ammeter on the beam because that's taking the beam out of the machine. So you got to do something a little bit more fancy, but not that much. And then centroids, and then the beam sizes. If we can get there, I will talk a little bit about beam losses, but I have the feeling most of this lecture is going to be talking about these things, about centroids and beam position monitors. Some of that is in chapter 14 of the text, and then beam sizes and things that measure the beam size and properties of the beam size I'm going to riff on based on experience at this machine. So this is a picture. That picture there is of CBAF, the machine that hopefully you will be coming to visit and see on May 19th during our open house at Jefferson Lab. This is each one of these linear accelerators here is about a kilometer long, give or take. Suba here on Monday, or Tuesday, sorry, will be talking about the devices that accelerate the beam through these LINAC RF cavities. And we'll start talking about not just the transverse stuff about the beam that we've talked about all semester, but talk about some of the longitudinal stuff about the beam. How do we make it accelerate? And how do we also keep the bunches, the collection of particles, focused, not just transversely, but in the longitudinal direction as well? So you can see here the little arrows. You follow the arrows. Beam starts out at this little green box, the injector, goes through a portion of the accelerator and gets accelerated. Down here, there's essentially like a beam prism. It's a big dipole. The lower momentum you are, the more you bend. The higher momentum you are, the less you bend, just like a real prism. And so the lower momentum particles go around the top portion of this track and come back down, accelerate again, go around that top portion, and get back in here and catch the same wave and accelerate yet again. But now they have even more momentum, so they bend a little bit less, and things, particles go around this thing up to 5 times or even 5.5 times before they go out to one of these experimental halls and get used for nuclear physics purposes. So there is the thing to emphasize here is this is a big machine, right? If each of those is a kilometer long, it's not like we're just going to measure the beam here and measure the beam here when it comes out. There's a whole lot of correction going on to make the beam go through these little channels all the way around the accelerator. So you need to be able to measure properties of the beam. And just like any good feedback system or any good, you know, system where you're going to adjust things to make it work, just like steering your car, you're going to need measurements and you're going to need actuators. So to change the direction of the beam, use dipoles, small dipoles, because a dipole changes the direction of all of the particles together uniformly. It steers the centroid of the beam, but it steers all the other particles exactly the same way. Quadrupoles, on the other hand, remember, if you're going through the center of a quadrupole, you don't change your direction. You don't see any field. If you're off to the side, you see field that points you towards the center or points you away from the center. So all the different particles experience different deflections and different forces from quadrupoles, and that means you're changing the beam size. Intrinsically, that's what quadrupoles do. They change the beam size. So now I've got measurements and corrections of the beam size And we'll talk a little bit about how that closes and in accelerator physics terms, how that sort of a correction loop is closed. And then beam losses, you know, whatever you can do to make beam losses go down, because you usually don't want beam where you don't want beam. So we've talked a lot about transverse dimensions. The longitudinal dimension is a little bit easier. It's usually a repetitive structure in time. This is actually a picture taken out of a paper from my old machine, the relativistic heavy ion collider. And these are actual real measurements of pulses of beam going by. And you can see the time scale is like 100 nanoseconds in between these pulses, 107.7. And the, you know, relative length of these pulses is on the order of nanoseconds. So quick, you guys are physicists, how long is a nanosecond? Yeah.
-9.
Huh? 10 to the minus 9 seconds, but how long is a nanosecond? A good answer is about a foot, right? A nanosecond is about a foot, 3 nanoseconds is about, you know, a yard, a little bit, you know, meter-ish, right? 3/10 to the 8th meters per second is the speed of light, 2.997 or whatever, right? So if you take 1/3/10 to the 8th, you get 1/3 of a meter is a nanosecond. So at the speed of light, at least, that all makes sense. And these particles are pretty much hyper-relativistic. They're ultra-relativistic. If they were hyper-relativistic, I'd run off and gather my Nobel Prize right now, because that would mean that they broke the light barrier. But anyway, so this is, you know, this is a typical structure of beam in the longitudinal space. You can see that they didn't spread out. Okay, some of the particles are going to have slightly different momentum than some of the other particles, so they're going to be moving at slightly different velocities, which means if I leave them there without any other forces acting on them, the fast guys are going to get ahead and the slow guys are going to lag behind, and this stuff is going to spread out in time. How do we longitudinally focus these? Come to Suba's lecture on Tuesday and find out. But the other thing is that this, whatever device this is that's measuring the amount of beam, you know, going by in this kind of high frequency, in a high time precision way, at least, if I integrate under the curve, that should give me something like a total charge, right? So if I can integrate the total charge in here, I'm getting roughly how much charge has gone by. If I look at the instantaneous charge through any little slice in here and divide that by the time, I can figure out, okay, what's the current? What's the beam current look like? So current and charge, you know, are close to equivalent. It partly depends on what time scale you're looking at. So how do you do this? How do you measure this? Well, one simple thing is if I take a charge, or if I take a current, and I just run it through some current loop, like this lower left picture in here, right? I can get an induced current, right? It's basically like a transformer where this is the primary winding, and now this is the secondary winding. And if I look at the current on the secondary winding of this transformer, I get something like this current, right? It's an AC coupling, so it's an AC current. I can't measure DC current this way. If I had a constant current running through this, there's no coupling anymore, right? Transformers are AC devices. But I can get at least a very, very kind of rough idea of how the current is changing with time in a very simple device like this, where I just stick some sort of a ferrite coil on here and wrap some other wire around it. However, that has some issues because it's an AC device. It has an intrinsic bandwidth. It's related to the inductance of this coil, right? It can't go up to infinite frequency. You know that from transformers as well. And it can't go down to DC in particular. So what can I do? Well, I can make this thing very low inductance and have it have a very good frequency response. That's how I get to high frequencies. This little trick over here, this thing is called a DCCT, a DC current transformer. And the cool trick about this is how you use this principle to measure DC. You can even measure DC currents this way. So let me draw out roughly the principle behind the DCCT, because that diagram gives you the general idea. So in a DCCT, I have a current, okay, running through, and now I have two toroids that are counterphased. For those of you that play guitar, this is otherwise known as humbucked, and you use it to get rid of extraneous noise on your guitar pickups. Okay, so now these toroids, I mean, if I've got a delta I, if I've got a current, it induces a change in those. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to do some wrap some coils around here, and I'm going to put those through some sort of a little device. Well, one thing I'm going to do is I'm going to run an AC current through on those. And then I'm also going to put in here a clever little DC ammeter with kind of a little Wheatstone bridge device that looks like four diodes. Okay, and then I get out of there some sort of an ammeter there. Okay, so what's happening here? I've got, let me color code these guys just to, so this is one, and what's happening to the signal on these guys versus time? Let's say this is time, and this is induced voltage. Well, I'm running an AC on these, so for zero current, what I do is I have, okay, on one of these coils, I'm running an AC in one direction. Okay. And for another one of these coils, I'm running an AC that's counterphased. Right? So that's fine. What this little diode Wheatstone bridge does is that's effectively a rectifier. You guys know what a rectifier is? Rectifiers change AC into DC. They pull out the DC component of an AC signal. So here, the DC, you know, after rectification, effectively what that signal looks like. What's the DC component of this thing? They average out to zero. So this thing is flat zero. Okay? However, if there's a DC current in there, what the DC current does is the DC current will now kind of put on an average. It'll bias both of these. Except it'll bias them in opposite directions because they're counterphased. Humbucked. Right? So now if I look at the rectified signal, this ammeter down here, what I do is I get now the average of these bias signals now, which is something that is quite obviously non-zero. I I can use transformers to measure DC current, which is kind of an amazing thing, because transformers are kind of, by definition, not DC things. So this was a really, you know, clever instrument design. It's been around for quite a while. If any of you have ever used like a clamp ammeter, let's say you're working on something in somebody's lab and you want to measure the current on something that has a cable going into it and a cable going out of it, there are these handheld devices where you can clamp on and measure the current going through a wire. It's a clamp ammeter, it's called, and a clamp ammeter uses this technology. It's got a little driver in it and a little rectifier in it, and then that's all you do, is you pick up the rectified signal out of there. So this is the principle behind DCCTs. These things can measure, average beam currents. This is something that is now, you know, does not really have good time domain stuff. It doesn't have good time response, but it measures the overall average current of your beam really well, right? So average, this is good for average current, for kind of the average current of the beam, but it's bad for, you know, fast, something like current with time. So I'll post the slides for you, Eric.
All right, appreciate it.
Sure. You too.
So would you use these two things in conjunction to get the full idea of what the current is like?
That's exactly what you do. So I'm about to show you the other device that's good for fast time and bad for slow stuff, and that's called a wall current monitor. So let's look at something like that. So the DCCT senses the difference in the balanced windings through that rectifier there. That set of diodes is otherwise known as a rectifier. So how do you measure fast current? How do you measure things like that bunch structure that we saw back there? Because the frequency response of this thing, to have this good a picture, needs to be, you know, gigahertz, right? This is not really old technology. People didn't start inventing gigahertz digital oscilloscopes until 10-15 years ago. Megahertz were fine. Gigahertz is kind of tough. Gigahertz is starting to get challenging. So here we have the device that does this sort of thing, and this is a picture I stole from a friend, Marc Gaisiart at CERN, because it's a pretty three-dimensional image, and that tells you something new that you may not have realized, but you may have wondered about. So this is the beam, and the beam is traveling usually in an evacuated beam pipe, right? It's going through something that is a metallic cylinder, and because the beam, a charge, is going through this metallic cylinder, it would lose, you know, huge radiative effects unless it had some sort of countercurrent that was also running around with it on the surface of that beam pipe, right? You need to be able to draw some sort of Gaussian surface out here and say, by gosh, the enclosed current is zero. So there is what's called an image current. Because this beam pipe is conductive, there is an image current always running around on the surface of this beam pipe. And if you make your beam pipes completely out of insulator and try and make a particle accelerator, you will very quickly find that it does not work. That what will happen is charge will build up on your insulator and not move, and beam will fall out of your machine because it loses energy trying to move that charge through that insulator. So what you have, so now, because there's this image charge moving around with our beam, there's that image current effectively moving around with that beam. That image current is, you know, little loops on the surface of this conductor. If I break that conductor and I put some resistors into it, just like, you know, a regular voltmeter or something like that, I can measure now the voltage across those resistors and get a current, right? And that's exactly what you do with a wall current monitor. You put in a bunch of resistors, you put in some way of forcing the high frequency stuff through those resistors. Low frequency stuff can go around through this beam pipe. This big orange thing in here is ferrite. It's something that will kind of let the low frequency stuff move through, but will resist the high frequency stuff. It has a very frequency dependent permittivity. And so what you do now is you have the high frequency beam signal essentially forced to go through this ring of resistors. And if you put some voltmeter across this and measure that at an appropriate frequency, you can get, you know, very, very detailed pictures of the exact longitudinal distribution of the beam as it goes through this. You want to be careful about this because if you build this the wrong way, it does have a chance of interacting with the beam and deforming the beam. If these resistors are too high or there's even a complete break within this beam pipe, that's bad. That means the image current can't go around, right? So you've got to have, you know, in some sense, kind of match your circuit, match your impedances to make this work properly. But you can still get, if you get the right resistors in here, this can have a good frequency response up to multi-gigahertz, right? Some of the literature I looked at earlier today is like 10 to 20 gigahertz, which is on the order of, you know, tenths of nanoseconds of resolution, which is great, right? Sub-nanosecond resolution. So this is cool, and if you do this with a fast enough scope, now you can produce a picture like this, which is exactly the type of device that works up at this collider to produce this sort of a picture. Another cool thing about this picture, you notice that these guys are distributed kind of azimuthally around the beam pipe. So oftentimes they're usually just daisy-chained together and you measure the voltages at several places. There's no reason why you couldn't measure the voltage on each one of those resistors individually. And now you can say, oh, there's a little more image current on this side than on this side. So maybe the beam is closer to this side with a little more image current and a little further away from that side with a little less image current. And you can not only get a feeling for how much current is going through, but you can do the next thing we've talked about, which is start to measure the beam position. And if you do this with enough of these resistors, you start thinking, maybe I can even measure moments of the distribution in XY space. If the beam is offset and the beam is a little bit elliptical or longitudinal, all of this image current is going to carry that information. But you really need to have a super kind of stupidly high frequency response in this thing to be able to get all of that. Plus, now you have to have 10 gigahertz, you know, instead of one 10 gigahertz scope, you now have N 10 gigahertz scopes where it's the number of moments that you want to measure. And 10 gigahertz scopes are expensive. They're like, you know, tens of thousands of dollars a piece. So you're not just running out and, you know, building a bunch of these and equipping them with these super scopes. It's not terribly financially feasible. So
you use multiple megahertz scopes that are all just a bit out of phase?
Does
that become as expensive?
Multiple megahertz scopes, you're still subsampling the distribution, right? Because the distribution that's going by, that thing that's going by, has a time structure that is on the order of nanoseconds, right? Those things are only 8 nanoseconds wide. Right, so you're subsampling stuff, maybe not unless you're locked to exactly the frequency of the beam going by. You don't know when in phase you're measuring relative to the beam. If you've got that kind of timing accuracy of measuring exactly at that phase, it already means you have a clock running around the system that's that fast, right? And why trigger your megahertz scope with a gigahertz, you know, perfectly time signal? You could, in principle, do some of that. I bet you it's going to be really noisy, because you know, a picture like this, if you can sample many times through the bunch, you can measure a distribution. If you just measure at one point in the bunch and that longitudinal distribution is changing a little bit, it's going to fake you out and it's going to make it look like the transverse moments are changing instead. And that's I'll get to that in a second, because that picture, there's a picture in the book of BPMs that we looked at RIC that do exactly kind of that thing. So you know, thank you for leading the question a little bit. So this is how you measure currents, either with DCCTs or with very high frequency with these intercepting kind of wall current monitor type things. And this is great because now you can intercept this image current without having to intercept or deform the main actual beam current. These things are non-destructive measurements. They don't kill the beam. So these pictures are taken from the book. This is going to chapter 14. Chapter 14 in the book didn't talk at all about the DCCTs or the current measurement stuff, but it does talk quite a bit about beam position measurements. So there's this nice picture stolen from the book. This is the beam going through that beam pipe. And now you start to look at, okay, what's the electromagnetic field of a beam look like? Because I'm going to have to take not the image current, which I know is running around on the edges, but I'm going to have to somehow interact with the actual beam electromagnetic field itself. So I've got the beam in the beam frame. What have I got? Well, okay, it's in the beam frame at least. What I've got is, gosh, I'm in the beam frame, so everything is at rest. So this is that's all electric field, man, right? Because I'm kind of at rest with regard to the center of the electromagnetic field, and it's uniform, it's isotropic, it's 1 over r squared, it's all of those good things. So this is in the beam frame. Now if I move into something like the lab frame, and this is a relativistic boost, Lorentz boost, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take all of these vectors that are uniform and isotropic, and by gosh, I'm boosting in some longitudinal direction, and I get length contraction and time dilation in the longitudinal directions, but not in the transverse directions. So what I have instead, well, first of all, my bunch gets, shorter to a certain extent, and all of those field lines, start to compress. And in fact, those field lines tend to compress. I think this opening angle is something like 1 over gamma, where gamma is the relativistic factor. Right, so as I boost, at least now this guy is moving in this direction with some beta. And that is the relativistic beta, not the betatron, or not the Kranz-Snyder twist parameter beta, but that is, huh? There are an infinite number of betas if you go outside of our field, but these are the two worst betas in our field. It's always be careful and always pay attention to context, because those two betas, it's not hard to get them mixed up. So in any event, though, what's happening here is I get these electric field lines that all kind of get compressed together, and there are also magnetic field lines that occur, because now there's areas where the electric field is changing in space and time because of all of non-isotropic aspect of this. So magnetic field lines get created as well. Okay. If I start to put this in a beam pipe, Well, now what I've got is I've got my distribution, and it's moving in this direction. And now I've got those electric field lines that tend to radiate out from this thing in these, you know, kind of 1 over gamma type cones. But they can't go on infinitely straight because the electric field lines would intersect this conductor. And gosh, if you remember freshman physics or E&M, right, electric field lines need to be perpendicular to the surface of a conductor. So these electric field lines have a tendency to bend to the point where they are perpendicular to the surface of that conductor. So as the beam is moving, think of it as this little kind of narrow pancake, you know, having this pancake field that is, you know, on the order of, you know, something like the length of the beam. It's a little bit bigger, but not that much, because that opening angle, that 1 over gamma, is very, very small. Right? And so what you have is you have something kind of like the picture that's put in the textbook here, where you can see, again, those field lines, they're a little bit compressed in the back of the bunch rather than the front of the bunch, because the beam is going from left to right here. And they're also perpendicular to the conductive beam pipe, where there is an image current running along. So that's fine. So just like our wall current monitor, where we put resistors in, well, instead of putting resistors in, we can put things that interact with this field that create possible reflections, or that catch some of this electrical impulse and send a signal down something like a coax line. These are generally 50 ohm matched types of things, but this is, notice that there's still a path for the image current to come around and get through. And there's also a path for this impulse to ring an electromagnetic signal down in this direction and then go to some sort of a scope, right? So if you look at this thing, flip this in this direction, 90 degrees, so the beam is coming out of the page. 4 of these pickups on the beam pipe here would look like maybe little buttons or even little strips that are coming in and out of the page here. So this is what's known as a beam position monitor, because now what I've got is, just like, remember I had talked about having maybe, you know, multiple resistors in the wall current monitor measuring signals. Well, think of this as 4, you know, not quite resistors, but 4 little breaks in the beam pipe that are measuring different electromagnetic signals coming from the beam in different angles and different positions, right? So if the beam is closer to one than the other, it's going to have a higher signal than the other. The book has a long set of math that goes into the derivation. I had that pulled up on a slide here, where the book talks about transverse position measurement, has this picture of a beam position monitor without that little bit of math that I wrote down. And now I've got these 4 signals that get 4 voltages coming out as the beam goes by. So this is the picture I was just mentioning, right? Which is, so in the time domain, let's say I look at this scope without the virtue of a filter. Just look at the raw scope at this signal coming down the line. And what you see is something that is, you know, in principle, oh my God, that looks horrible. There is all kinds of high-frequency structure on this. This thing is not perfectly matched. There's some ringing down there. In a perfectly kind of electrically matched system, what do you get? Okay, let's say a Gaussian beam. In a perfectly matched system, what would I get? On you know, BPM pickups here, what would I measure in terms of a voltage versus time? Well, what I would get is I would get, in principle, something that looks like this. Okay. what you're doing is you're really measuring induced current. It's very, again, very much like a transformer. As current goes by, as field goes by, it induces a current. That current flows one direction, and then it has to flow back and settle back again. Charge has to be conserved. And charge being conserved is effectively the same thing as saying that the area under each one of those curves, positive and negative, have to be equal. Because, gosh, voltage being created means charge is flowing one way. Voltage being created the other way means charge is flowing the other way. Well, the charge is sloshing back and forth. And if this charge is perfectly matched, so that there's, you know, the impedance is perfectly matched, you slosh back and forth once, exactly with the time structure of the derivative of the beam. So this thing looks like the derivative of the beam longitudinal distribution. So the beam longitudinal distribution is, let's say, so this black thing is that, and the longitudinal distribution of the beam is something like, you know, it's going to be a peak at this zero crossing, and then it's going to come down again, and that's our Gaussian beam. Right? So I have some inductive pickup that has a response that looks like the derivative of the beam. Now, okay, both of these guys are seeing the beam at the same time because they're both at the same location. So by gosh, the zero crossing, you know, will be the same on each one of them, but it could be different amplitudes of signal. Which means that I'm closer to one pickup than the other. So some combination of those voltages should give me a feeling for, am I closer to one side or closer to the other? I should be able to convert it via something to a position. Now, the real question is that difference linear in the position or quadratic in the position or, you know, some sort of crazy logarithm or whatever it is, right? What is the function that converts these voltages back to position? You could build a device that measures that for your particular beam position monitor system and just put that function into a DSP and do it kind of on the fly automatically. But the book goes through the math. We won't go through all of the math because it is a bit tedious. The other thing that happens is if your electrical system is not perfectly impedance matched, A, you're going to get ringing, which is exactly what this ringing is out here. And B, what you're going to get is you're going to get this kind of, horrible high-frequency stuff possibly coming through. And now the question is, where do I compare the beam position? Where do I compare these signals to take, you know, see if I'm closer to one button or the other? If those things don't have exactly the same frequency, you know, oscillations in here, if one of the pickups is not exactly the same impedance as the other pickup, its high frequency structure is going to be different than the other pickup, and now I'm just lost. So you really have to be careful to make sure the impedance of these things are exactly the same. So the book goes through all of the careful derivations, including a nice little use of image charges. Yay! Which are always a convenient trick for experienced physicists to figure out things, because I've got a charge moving inside a perfect conductor cylinder, so I can use image charges outside that perfect conductor cylinder and enforce equipotential requirements on that cylinder. And when you go through all of the math and figure things out, and it is multiple pages of not-so-illuminating math, you can, in fact, find out that, by gosh, the ratio, if I take the natural log of those voltages on two of those pickups, it is, in fact, linearly proportional to first order to the beam offset. So, by gosh, I can take those measurements of voltages at a particular time and do some math, and it gives me a good position measurement. And the correction terms are cubic. They're not x squared, but they're cubic. As well, they better be, because if they were quadratic, then the symmetry of the system would be violated. So here you have a much better picture, right? This figure 14.5, a much better picture of what I drew over here on the sheet, which is what these typical signals look like. And I think I even took this data back in the old days. So this is a very, very well-centered beam. You can see that both signals on both pickups are almost exactly on top of each other. There's no ringing, so they're both perfectly matched. And so now I can take the ratio at almost any one of these points. Almost always, for best signal noise, you take the ratio at the peak, if you can do it. And then you move the beam way off center, and by gosh, yes, the signal on one of them goes up and the signal on one of them goes down, but their time structure is otherwise the same as it was. They're still matched. They still, you know, go up and down. But now I can actually calibrate this beam position monitor based on these little measurements of these values on this screen, right? So this is how you do beam position, is you have a bunch of these devices that measure these positions. Now you don't need a scope on all of these. What we did, instead of having something that has a very, very kind of high-frequency digitizer like a scope, what you can do is you can build some electronics that filters this down, so it stretches this thing out in time, nice and long, and then you can actually build something called a peak detector that will find that peak and trigger something to capture that peak, and then you can use a very, very slow analog to digital converter. I mean, the ones we used were very cheap in this machine. They ran at like 10 kilohertz or something, not megahertz level, $10 a piece or whatever it was. But that's okay, because we have 300 of these in each of the rings of this big accelerator. So there are ways to fold this information down and get this information out and do a tremendous amount of noise reduction as well. But this gives you the feeling for kind of how these things actually work. They intercept, you know, they're coupling directly to the beam electromagnetic fields. You're getting something that looks like the derivative of the beam distribution, because you're getting kind of a swoosh of charge and then a swoosh back of charge as the circuit is perfectly matched. And then you go through all of the calculations and find out that the ratio of the voltages is in fact related right in a nice linear way to the actual beam position. So that's beam position monitors, and gives you a feeling for what BPMs are like. So now that's all good. That's all good and well. So now we know, it's that one. I always hit these things so too. So we know how to measure beam positions now. And in fact, what we usually do is we usually do that measurement a whole bunch of times and average them all together and then reduce the noise even further. Good systems can have kind of like a distribution, you know, a typical resolution and or precision of the system can get down to something like 5 to 10 microns. Great systems, something that you would put in a very, very specialized place like near the collision point of the International Linear Collider, where the beams are terribly, terribly small, this thing, you know, can even get down on the order of something like 10 nanometers. And there you really need a ton of signal processing and noise reduction to get down to that level. You're not measuring the location of the centroid of one bunch of beam going by to that precision. You're measuring thousands of them and averaging and doing reporting the position very, very slowly. So that's fine. Okay. So now we need to correct. Because now what I've got is I've got, you know, my accelerator system, and my accelerator system has, gosh, a bunch of magnets in it. Maybe some of the magnets are not exactly focused the same way, and there's other stuff going on. But what I've got is I've only got these devices, you know, the few particular locations. And when I measure the beam at these locations, I really kind of, you know, in a perfect world, I want the beam to be zero at each one of these locations. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to build into my system, I'm also going to build in things like dipole correctors. So remember, what dipoles do is dipoles can change now the beam direction by changing the strength of the dipole. So if the beam is in the wrong place on this particular BPM, what I do is I change this particular dipole corrector. If the beam is on the wrong location on this BPM, I change that dipole corrector. Right? I can set things up so that there is almost a one-to-one correspondence. It isn't always the case. But in this case, you know, let's call this, gosh, we've learned all about these things. Let's say this is a matrix M going from location 1 to location 2, where 1 is this corrector and 2 is this BPM, right? What am I doing? I have X and X prime at location 2 is equal to M12 at the first location. What does a dipole corrector do? Right, a dipole corrector changes the angle. The dipole corrector does not change the position, at least not at the dipole corrector itself. So what I did is my dipole corrector is changing this angle at this location, doesn't change the position, and now I'm going to look at the overall effect and see, you know, what happens here. Well, gosh, what happens there is that I'm going to end up having now an X and an X prime 2. I do this. Well, this is the original position. And now if I multiply this thing by this, what I get, certainly in terms of position, I get, you know, this little M12 times delta X prime. And this is M22 at delta X prime. Remember, the M12 in terms of betas looked like the square root of beta 1, beta 2, times the sine of this betatron angle between these two points. And the M22 looked like something complicated. Don't worry about it. Because what's location 2? Location 2 is a thing that only measures positions. So this is really the stuff that I correct and care about. And that when I mentioned before that, gosh, M12 was the thing that you care about the most when you're doing this type of correction of making sure the beam is staying in the beam pipe or staying going down the middle. It's because all you can measure is positions, and when all you can measure is positions, what's the effectiveness of the thing you're using to fix the position? It's related to these betas and this betatron phase of the system between those two locations. And it can be, you know, if I design, it's possible I could design a system here where I have a corrector and a beam position monitor, and if I change this corrector, I launch, you know, what I'm doing is I'm changing the angle of the beam at this location, right? Instead of going like this, it goes like this. Well, the beam can go through, you know, maybe some focusing magnet here and end up at the beam position monitor exactly back at zero again. Gosh, that's exactly 90 degrees away in this phase, and I end up not being able to change the position at all at this beam position monitor with this dipole corrector because they're exactly out of phase. So far, so good. We have beam position monitors, we have dipole correctors, we've talked about correcting the optical system, at least the centroids, getting the centroid of the beam where we want the centroid of the beam to go. So that's good. So centroids are taken care of. Centroids are okay. Dipole correctors and BPMs. But what about now the sigmas or the RMS or the beam sizes? Okay. So now what I've got is I've got this optical system. And I'm going through some set of magnets. And as I'm going through the set of magnets, I actually have some sort of beam size or beam envelope. It's getting smaller, it's getting bigger, it's getting smaller again. So how do I measure this? This is in our good old phase space X and X prime, right? I had some distribution of particles that looked like an ellipse. And now what I want, I don't want to measure the centroid anymore, but I actually want to measure something about the entire distribution of particles. Oops, sorry. So here, measuring the distribution of particles, this is almost always destructive. Okay, I gotta put something in the way of that set of particles. I got to get in its way and measure something about it. I can't, except for this very, very, that wall current monitor thing I was talking about, that's not a very good measure of beam size. And except for other things, which we'll talk about later, in particular synchrotron radiation, for now, let's just think of ways to measure this beam, but allow ourselves the liberty of doing something like putting something in its way. So it's real easy. First thing is very straightforward, and that is, by gosh, you know, put some image here. You know, this is a phosphor screen. And if you measure with that phosphor screen, what you can get is you can get quite literally, you know, some image of the beam. And if you calibrate the size, the pixel size of that phosphor screen, because you can move the beam around and move the centroid around, and you know from your optics how far you're moving it around at that particular location. Now, in fact, I can measure not just where the beam is, but now I can measure the beam sizes, sigma x and sigma y. Right? I can look at the orientation of that beam. I can play with the orientation of that beam. I can play with quadrupoles and get that beam shape exactly right there using the equations that we had talked about last class, which is fine, which is all good. This, however, so this is not terribly precise. Turns out that the screen, it's also, these are also called flags that you insert, that they tend to have very, very kind of nonlinear response with intensity. So if you're trying to measure, you know, the distribution of intensity across a beam and the center is really bright and the edges are really dim, then you need a big, huge dynamic range, and you want that dynamic range to be linear in the intensities, and that's not really good enough. So you know, these things are not terribly linear. What people do sometimes is they even to get around that, they adjust the dynamic range of the cameras looking at these things and the screens themselves, and they make little slits, and they run that little slit across the beam. So they only image a little piece of the beam, and they adjust the range of their imaging as they run that slit across the beam. And then you can get a bit better, because you're only looking at a smaller portion of the dynamic range of the beam. It's like trying to take a picture of of the sun, right? That's very, very bright in the middle and kind of, okay, dimmer at the edges. But if you hold something up, you know, that's a little slit, and change the dynamic range as you scan through, you can get much, much better imaging going on there. So that's one way you can use slits to improve the dynamic range. But there's a better way, okay? And the better way is, let's take this picture of this beam line again. Let's take this rough idea of this is what our beam envelope is looking like, moving through our optical system. And now what I've got is I've got this beam that I want to image. And so, just like a slit slices one little bit away, what I can do is I can take a wire and I can move a wire through this, and then I can have some camera that watches signals from that wire as the wire moves through the beam. So this is called a wire scanner. I'll draw a line here. It's also called a HARP. We prefer wire scanners, at least. And what you do is you count interactions as the wire moves through the beam. And if you can get, you know, particle physicists are all about counting interactions, are all about fast detectors. Megahertz is no problem. So you can get really, really good dynamic range, you know, from subhertz down to many megahertz. And it's really linear because it's counting stuff. So it's quite, you know, you can get very, very good precision measurements by doing this. It takes a little bit longer. On the other hand, it's also You can do this with high-intensity beams rather than, if you do this with too high-intensity beam, you punch a hole in your phosphor. So you can't do this with super high-intensity beam. The other thing that you can do is you can do fancy things now. Instead of, let's say that the beam is coming, the beam direction is coming out at us. What I can do is I can build some device that moves three wires through the beam. Okay? So these three wires moving through the beam and this is the wire scanner. Whoop. What happens is that if this is moving at a 45 degree angle, effectively this looks like a vertical scan because that wire, that wire is moving at 45 degrees, but really, this dimension doesn't count because he's a horizontal wire. So he looks like he's only moving vertically through the thing. This thing looks like a horizontal scan because he effectively, this dimension of motion doesn't matter. So he's only moving what looks like horizontally through the wire. And then what I can see is I do a real plot of this image and I get three Gaussian-like things. These are counts versus insertion position. Right? And so the first thing that I get is this. This is the vertical. This is the horizontal. And then this is some kind of, diagonal cross-section in the middle that tells me something about coupling again. So these are the two kind of dominant ways that are destructive to measure beam sizes. Either in some machines, like at the Fermilab Tevatron in the old days, they had some wires that would move through the beam very, very quickly because they had really, really good counters. And those things were called flying wires. And they would talk about flying the wires to measure the average beam size. You're not moving the wire through this beam at nanosecond rates, though, right? It's you're not measuring individual bunches when you do this sort of thing. You are measuring, on average, all of the bunches that are going through this device together. And if this is very, very slow, then this is going to be kind of the average of all of those, or the convolution of all of those really summed together. So this is the two ways that you measure beam sizes, is looking at these phosphor screens or flags, and then looking at HARPs this way. But now you can start to see, you can start to get some idea of that insertion position. Okay, there needs to be a factor of square root of 2 in there. We forgot about that when we were starting up CVAF this time around. Oops, but then we fixed it, but it's kind of obvious from the geometry. And also, if this wire is too thick or that beam is too small, you need to start putting in some corrections because a thick beam, if I'm trying to measure something submicron by sweeping this thing across the submicron thing, I'm really measuring the size of this thing, not the size of the submicron thing, right? So if the beam size and the wire size are anywhere comparable, you have to realize that this picture you're getting is a true Gaussian, or really a Gaussian and cylindrical projection convolution of the two together. And you have to do some careful math to deconvolve those things.
What kind of wire is it exactly?
It's oftentimes something like a carbon nanofiber, carbon fibers nowadays These wires, the thickness of the wire, can be on the order of 5 to 10 microns. Okay, which is, and you know, for beam sizes that are on the order of tens to hundreds of microns, this is great because it's small enough that you don't need to worry about that convolution stuff. But getting wires that are 1 micron, forget about that. You know, there's, as you're trying to install them and put any tension on them, they just break. And if the wires are too small, you can also end up, as you're sweeping this through, you can get some charge deposition on them. If they're insulators and that charge deposition can damage the wires, there's all kinds of stuff that you know, details, engineering details that go into these things. But the underlying philosophy is these are both direct measurements of beam size, right, of sigma, of sigma X and sigma Y. And those direct measurements of sigma X and sigma Y, now I can go back and I can change my M matrix by changing quadruples. And gosh, I have that nice equation that we had from the last class about how beam sizes before and beam sizes after depend on that M transpose and the M matrix being multiplied together. So now I have a true correction system again. I can make a measurement, understand my optic system, and put in something that I can truly calculate how to change the beam size in a controlled way. And it's linear, which is great because you want the process to converge predictably. So this is a good place to stop, I think, for now, considering my parking runs out in 10 minutes.
So for only out there and in the feedback machine?
Harps?
Yeah, or the prosperous.
There's, screens there are on the order of about 20, and harps there on the order of about 30. So we have quite a few harps in the machine.
So you would want one after every quadruple and every sextuple?
No. Yeah, right. If you put too many in the machine, so let me pull up the CBAF picture. And we can talk through this. Let's see. So remember to sign up for the presentation that you want, except Suba, who gets RF next week. So this is the CBAF machine, this picture. Okay. So generally, at the entrance of each one of these arcs, we have harps that we use to fix the beam size and correct it, to adjust it to the proper thing. But as it goes through the arc, we know those magnets well enough that we kind of believe that it doesn't get too far out, too badly set up and tuned. So there are harps in the middle of some of these arcs. There are harps at the beginning of some of these arcs. But, you know, it's on the order of that many. And then as you go into the experimental halls, there are a couple of them to get the beam convergence just right. If you have two beam position monitors, you can measure angle, because you can measure position at two different locations. If you have two of these profile monitors, these harps or wire scanners, you can measure the actual beam convergence, because you're measuring the beam size at two different locations. And so, you know, that's the complete description of the beam right there, and then you can adjust all of your quadruples and fix everything to make sure it gets to the next place you measure. But it's not that many for CBAF. Even a large machine, it's 30 or 40, it's not hundreds of times. There are hundreds of beam position monitors, because centroid goes out of whack very quickly. But the beam size doesn't get that bad that fast. And I'll leave that as an exercise 3 to figure out why.